You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a Wisconsin expert on wildfires and development joins us for a look at the Maui wildfires, why they burn so quickly and cause so much devastation. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about self-love.
Feeling like you're different from your peers can have a big impact on your self-acceptance. But as Miriam Brabham of Green Bay tells us, a nurturing community helped her learn how to love her hair. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
When I was young, I hated my hair. It spent most of its time tightly pulled into lopsided buns, surrounded by a halo of curly flyaways. In those early years, my curls were traumatized. They were dehydrated and unappreciated, and they were a visual reminder of what I didn't know and how I didn't fit in. As a multi-ethnic Black girl who was also a Messianic Jew, 9-year-old me saw my curls as yet another thing that othered me. At a North Chicago YMCA, I would watch the other girls after swim class with envy. Passing small combs through their wet, straight hair, they would sigh and huff as they started from the top of their heads and found resistance at the ends. These girls would finish detangling their whole head in 5 minutes. After swim class, I didn't have time to wash my thick hair. While the smell of Pantene and Suave filled the air, I used the water to help me gather my curls into an outstretched scrunchie. These rebellious curls, stinking of chlorine and a lack of information, would begin to clump together into impossible knots, almost as if they were so suffocated by the world that they coiled together for comfort. I hated my hair. It was time, effort, and a major contributor to my imposter syndrome collection. Not white enough, not Black enough, not Jewish enough, and yet too much. As I got older, the war with my hair became bitter. Temporary dyes, perms, and massive amounts of heat were met with split ends, chemical burns, and tension alopecia. Big chop after big chop left me at a shady hair braiding salon under the tracks on the north side of Chicago, where a woman used nail glue instead of hair glue and some overpriced box braids. Cutting out multiple braids, explaining why you shouldn't say good hair, and having monoracial people laugh at my ignorance left trauma residue all over my coils. The age of peace began when I started talking nice to my hair, instead of verbally berating it and subsequently myself. I learned so much about my hair while studying abroad in Botswana, Africa. The people were not shy or reserved in their comments and suggestions. They also didn't see me as separate from themselves. I just didn't know how to do my hair. The Botswana people taught me to love myself and my hair. I began to see my curls as an intrinsic part of myself. These curls can be playful springs that bounce in a sweet summer breeze. They can be strong, wide coils that keep the moisture to themselves and observe the world from scarves that set them on high. These curls can refuse to be tamed. They can go their own way, laughing at edge control and headbands alike. They can lay gently around my face. These curls define themselves and can easily change depending on the day and humidity. They have personality, and not shockingly, it's very similar to my own. So yes, there is trauma wrapped up in these curls. But like trauma in any of us, I am healing with love, time, and hair oil.
Miriam Brabham is a multicultural student success manager at UW Green Bay. And her story is part of the Home Is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of 6 media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the wildfires that tore across the Hawaiian island of Maui earlier this week were the country's deadliest in over a century. So far, over 100 people have been confirmed dead. That number is expected to increase as the remaining two-thirds of the burned area are searched. The town of Lahaina was hit particularly hard with over 2,000 buildings destroyed. It's not known what sparked the fires initially, but a lot of factors contributed to its intensity and spread, including dry conditions, fast-burning invasive grasses, and winds from Hurricane Dora. Our next guest has done research on the interaction between wildfires and the way we develop our buildings and communities around the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Maui wildfire and the impact of wildfires in general? Do you worry about wildfires and other natural disasters getting worse, maybe, as the impacts of climate change continue to develop? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Volker Rodloff is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Volker, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, you've studied the interaction between people and wildfires over the years. What stands out to you so far about what we know about the spread of these Maui wildfires?
The Maui wildfires were extreme. So the core of the destruction happened about in a two-hour period or so. And the high numbers, especially of life lost, and as you mentioned, over 100 confirmed already, and that number likely to increase. That is something we have not seen for a century or so. But the general condition of the combination of a fire starting in wildland areas, fueled by high winds, and then spreading into an urban area, suburban areas, and the houses become fuel, that's something we have seen increasingly in recent years.
Can you talk a little bit more about those conditions in Maui when this fire broke? Again, as you said, we don't know exactly what sparked it. It unfortunately was, it sounds like a perfect storm for the fast spread of this fire.
Absolutely so. And I think it's important to realize there were numerous fires already across all the Hawaiian Islands on the days before. So August 4th, the National Weather Service had given a warning of high wildfire risk due to the combination of dry condition and high winds from Dora. And on August 4th, there was already a 30-acre burn on Maui or so that was contained. On Tuesday the 8th, there was a fire on the eastern side of Maui at 12:22 a.m. that was called the Upcountry Fire. That ultimately burned about 1,000 acres, and a lot of the firefighters were working on that fire when then the Lahaina fire started at 6:37 a.m. That was initially a very small fire, only 3 acres, and by 10 a.m. it was reported that it was contained, that they had with dozers and so forth been able to control it or so. But then it flared up again in the afternoon at about 3:30. By 4:30, high winds, and then the embers, little burning pieces or so that the wind carried, had pushed all the way into the heart of Lahaina. By 4:45, an hour later, a lot of the exit roads were closed because of down power lines, because of cars that were burning and so forth, so people could not escape. And then by 5:45, the fire had reached the ocean front, and the Coast Guard is getting these horrifying messages of people in the water. So that's in a nutshell what happened in Lahaina, and it was incredibly fast due to these 80 miles per hour winds. And then as soon as the wildfire started, those embers were blowing into the settled areas, and then the houses themselves became fuel and created more embers that set more houses on fire.
Volker, I think of some types of ecosystems, like in the American West, maybe prairie places where there are quote-unquote natural wildfires, or ecosystems even rely on fire from time to time. As I understand it, in my very limited understanding, this is not true of Hawaii. This is not a place where we see, over the passage of time, regular wildfires. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, there is no natural wildfires, I mean, that this ecosystem would be adapted to. There may have been fires from volcanic eruption, from occasional lightning or so, but it was not a major part of that ecosystem prior to human habitation or so. So that is different from systems like chaparral in Southern California, or prairie savanna ecosystems in the Midwest, where fires were a much bigger part of the natural landscapes. And that is also important in the Hawaiian context, because the native plants are not adapted to fire. And when fires occur, they are lost. Those ecosystems are replaced by invasive species typically.
So this is a case where some level of human development and human change made wildfires more likely?
Absolutely, yes. And it's both a combination of the changes in the vegetation and the land cover, as well as then the ignitions that happen. And my understanding is also that what caused this fire exactly has not been determined. There's reports of downed power lines, and such power line problems have caused many other wildfires before, but that investigation will take time. And given the amount of destruction and the insurance issues and all that, I'm sure people will be very careful to make exactly sure that they pinpoint the causes exactly. But human ignitions are causing most of the wildfires that lead to the loss of lives and structures. So they are a big factor.
Let's get to something looming here, climate change. Do the impacts of climate change make outbreaks of wildfires likely in more and more places, like in this case, unfortunately, Maui?
The quick answer is yes, and long drought periods certainly are a big concern. In these systems like Maui, where invasive grasses and shrubs are an important part of the fuel, we're also concerned, though, about the combination where we have 1 year with high precipitation, a wet year, which allows a lot of this herbaceous matter to grow. And if that's followed by a dry year, then we have conditions for very large fires or very intense fires or so. So yes, the climate change plays a role, and it plays a role in these drought conditions. And what that has caused across the U.S. is that the fire season is much, much longer, where it used to be several months, and now wildfires occur 12 months of the year. And a few years ago, 21 in Boulder, we had the Marshall Fire in December or so. That was not fire season traditionally, and climate change is certainly a factor in that.
We're talking about the Maui wildfires and the interactions of people, development, and wildfires in general with Volker Radeloff, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the wildfire in Hawaii or the trend of wildfires in recent years? Maybe an experience where you lived in a community that experienced one. Join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you just tried to call and didn't get an answer, I think we've got the bugs ironed out there. You could try again. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Volker Radeloff, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison, looking at the Maui wildfires, what caused them to be so fast and extreme, and wildfires, people, and climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Kimberly is with us in Powell Lake. Kimberly, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Kimberly?
I just wanted to mention that if they were to trim the trees around their power wires like we do here, you know, 10 feet back, then they wouldn't have been entwined. And if they could have cut off the the power to those, knowing that the storm was coming, they could have avoided that explosion of fire. And also, they didn't cut off the electric, but they did cut off the water. And I found that kind of strange.
Kimberly, thanks for the call. I didn't know about the water cutoff. I know fire hydrants had very low pressure, I've been hearing. But Volker, the idea that some management of power lines, including, as Kimberly says, keeping vegetation away, turning them off when there are dangerous conditions imminent. What do you think about that?
Those are definitely good suggestions. Thanks, Kimberly. Yes. So making sure that there are no trees that in a high wind condition can fall on top of the power line and break them and pull them down is highly beneficial. Having said that, that requires more than 10 or 15 feet clearing. That would require in many areas much wider cuts or so. And if at the bottom of the power line there are grasses or shrubs or so, if the power line comes down and is sparking, then fires would still occur. Cutting off power is in high wind condition is good, and it is something that is done in California and so forth. But it also comes at a high cost. That means that people in places where it is hot and dry right now no longer have air conditioning. That has medical consequences for many people. It means that people may not no longer have television and radio to listen to alerts and so forth. So I'm not sure what went into the decision in West Maui not to cut off the power, but it's not a solution that is easily done. As I mentioned, there were at least 4 days of high wind before, and cutting power off for a long period or so is difficult or troublesome. In hindsight, of course, yes, had the power been cut off at that point, and if the power lines were indeed the cause of this fire, things would have been much better, and that is true. I should also mention, in terms of the clearing of the power lines, this is becoming a very tricky issue now because a lot of the companies that have done that traditionally can no longer get insurance to do so, because the insurance companies are saying, if these clearings of the power lines were not done quite correctly enough and a fire occurs, then the insurance payments for that are just way too high or so. So in California, I know that companies, electric companies, are right now struggling to even find contractors to clear trees along the power lines.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Folker, you've done research on human development, people building in areas that are prone to wildfires, the human-nature interface. What were some of the key things you found as you mapped these things out around the country?
Yeah, so those places are wonderful places to live in. I understand why people like to have their home there. These are places where the houses are close to wildland vegetation, to forests, to shrublands, to grasslands, some of which can burn. And across the U.S., about 30% of all housing units are in what we call the wildland-urban interface. That's the technical term. And we've worked on that issue with the Forest Service for the last 20 years or so, because it is a widespread problem. It makes wildfires a vexing problem. The issue is, first of all, human ignition. We talked about that a few minutes ago. In these places, fires are more likely to start because a barbecue grill topples over, power lines, and all of these issues are more concentrated there. And then when fires occur, it's not just firefighting that has to happen, but evacuations too, and protection of structures and so forth. And that complicates wildfire management greatly.
Let's go back to our callers with Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Jim, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. You know, I've been to Hawaii several times. It's been a while. My first comment is about the Hawaiian culture, is that they don't get too really concentrated concern about much of anything there. You know, in order to have a fire, there has to be fuel. And even though the hard facts have not been assessed yet, I'm afraid there was just too much fuel in the form of dry vegetation so close to town, and then the perfect storm comes along, and you know the result. I mean,
Jim, so. I gotcha. Thanks for the call. And this is a common ingredient, Folker, I think, in a lot of quick spreading wildfires, that accumulation, as Jim says, of dried vegetation.
Absolutely. Yes. No, and that is when a drought comes together with high wind conditions. And then in the wildland-urban interface, by definition, we have these wildland fuels close to houses. That is not unique to Hawaii, though. We have these fuel conditions in large parts of California, the Intermountain West. We have it in parts of Wisconsin and the eastern U.S. as well. The Gatlinburg fires of 2016 were exactly the same pattern. I mentioned the Marshall Fire in Colorado and so forth. So that all is common. The invasive species are particularly widespread in Hawaii. About a quarter of Hawaii is covered by invasive species that are highly flammable. And in the past, there was more active agriculture, sugarcane plantation, and so forth in Hawaii. That is no longer the case. Those former farm fields or agricultural fields are now covered by invasive species. So managing those fuels, Jim, I totally agree that is wise, that is necessary. That is not a trivial endeavor, though. Those are millions and millions of acres across the U.S., and how to manage them is not always clear. In case of these grassland, livestock grazing could maybe work, things like that, but prescribed burning, for instance, is not an option in those systems. It would just lead to even faster spread of these invasive species throughout the islands.
Thanks a lot for that call. Folker, I've had a couple of great conversations over the years with Stephen Pine, a fire expert who studied fire, its history all over the world. One thing I came away with is there isn't one solution that's going to work in this ecosystem and every ecosystem. The local fire characteristics may be very different from one place to another. Does that make it hard to come up with common solutions?
Very well put. Yes. Ecology is tricky because it's different in every place. And as you said, in Hawaii, we have too many fires and prescribed burning is not an option. in parts of the Sierras in California, we probably could use more prescribed burning, but in Southern California with chaparral, the fires are too frequent already. So the solutions have to be tailored to a given place and both to the native ecosystems, as well as to the settlement patterns and so forth. But I think it has to be a combination of fuel management, as well as thinking about evacuation, thinking about better ways of alerting people or so, and also, to some extent, the good old Smokey the Bear campaigns to stop ignitions to avoid, in these highly risky situations, fires from starting.
And Volker, just briefly, should more communities be doing more fire planning and make whatever that might look like in their community?
Absolutely. And I think community efforts are important. A lot of the vegetation management has to happen on private land or so. This is something that government agencies can help with, but communities and landowners have to step up. And they can do a lot. On average, in a given wildfire across the U.S., if a house is within the perimeter of that fire, it has only an 11% chance of burning. 89% of the houses survive. And a lot of that has to do with how the houses are built, how the vegetation is managed, and so forth. So there are things we can do. But yes, communities need to get together and take initiative.
Volker, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Volker Radloff is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He talked to us about the Maui wildfires and human development in general. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, young people sued the state of Montana over climate-related laws and won in a ruling out this week. It's part of a wider effort by younger Americans who are likely to face the biggest impacts of climate change. We'll find out what that ruling means for the future. And there's growing evidence that our guts have a lot to do with our physical and mental well-being, but there are a lot of unanswered questions. We'll visit our gut microbiome and look at products sold with claims that they boost our gut health. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we learn about some of the untold stories of professional football's origins pre-1920, including a game-fixing scandal that nearly wrecked the professional game's future. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll dig into the latest indictments against President Trump and others, this time in the state of Georgia. First, 1967 is a year that Green Bay Packers fans and fans of pro football in general will recall as the year of the first Super Bowl. Packers 35, Chiefs 10, by the way. Back up a few decades now to 1920, the official founding of the National Football League. But what happened before that? Pro football in America didn't just appear in 1920. Not only is there a nearly three-decade history of professional football before then, that story includes a game-fixing scandal that almost killed the sport in the country altogether. Our next guest spent about a decade researching that history, which includes a family connection to it all. And as the NFL's preseason gets underway, we're going to take a look way back at where it all started. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the origins of pro football in the United States? Is this something you have followed or looked into yourself? Do you happen to have any family connections that date back to the early days of pro football? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Greg Fisseri is a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His new book is called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is an amazing journey in the book, Greg, and it started off with you going through your great-grandpa's photos. Can you tell us what kicked off this project for you?
That's right. I knew growing up in Pittsburgh at my grandmother's house in a little industrial suburb called Wilmerding, about 10 miles east of the city, that he was one of the greats of the pre-NFL era. He was a center before the forward pass, so he was a key to the offensive line. And the forward pass was legalized in 1906, and he played for every world championship team in Pittsburgh and in Massillon, Ohio, from 1901 to 1906. So there were a few pictures on her wall that gave me put me on the scent, but it wasn't until she passed away in 2007 and I was cleaning out her house that I discovered the real treasure, which was a box of dozens of more original photos from his career, individual photos, team photos, buddy pictures. Some were identified, some weren't. And it led me to ask a lot of questions, find resources, find people that could help me identify the whole lot. And once I had it, sort of the story together, I ended up going to the Hall of Fame in 2012, and they really were amazed and validated how unique the whole collection was, that they hardly had anything from that period. And there was still much to be told about the story of that period and the for the original pioneers of the game that had been lost. So
I want to take this. I want to set the scene now with the early days, the first paid pro football players. Now, the college sport was big in the United States at this point. The rules that separated American football as we know it now from, you know, soccer and rugby had been in place for a couple decades now. It's a big college sport. Not a lot of interest initially in watching it at the pro level. Set that scene. What was America's attitude toward amateur and pro football at this time?
Correct. College football officially started in 1869. We had CFB 150 in 2019, 150 years. Princeton and Rutgers in New Jersey was the first game in 1869. The Scarlet Knights of New Jersey wore little red scarlet caps on their heads. And from there, the Ivy League ran with it. Harvard, Yale, Princeton were the big three. Penn came a little bit later, but they dominated the sport. And into the 1890s, it was then, you know, played at an amateur level, governed by the AAU, Amateur Athletic Union, covered and sort of supervised national championship sports in basketball, swimming, wrestling, you know, several sports. So if you were going to compete in anything AAU, it had to be at an amateur level. Professionalism was seen as sort of unethical, and it wasn't supported by the general public. So when football, you know, became popular at the adult level and played at many clubs, the main five in Pittsburgh were sponsored because there was a lot of money in the Industrial Revolution in Pittsburgh by companies. Homestead Steel became Carnegie Steel, became U.S. Steel. Homestead Steel sponsored a team that was the Western Pennsylvania champion in 1900 and sort of initially called the world champions in 1901 because they played a team from Philadelphia outside of Pittsburgh. And this was the first effort, really, to professionalize the sport. Eventually, somebody would get paid cash, and that would define the first pro player. So, and in 1892, it was discovered by the Hall of Fame when they opened in 1963 that a player named William Pudge Heffelfinger from Yale, an All-American, had received $500 in cash to play for them, for the Allegheny Athletic Association against their rival Pittsburgh Athletic Club. So they found this accounting ledger that they call the birth certificate of pro football, and it's on display in the Hall of Fame that showed that Heffelfinger got paid $500 in cash, which was a huge sum at that point, to play one game. And that defined the beginning of the pro era. So it went on in Pittsburgh from 1892 until 1902. And my great-grandfather played. His name was Bob Shiring for this Homestead team in 1901. That was the world championship team. And that was, at that point, the first picture I had of him on a football team. And that really started the journey. When the Hall of Fame said, you know, if you can combine these photos you have with a narrative that is missing the solution to an alleged gambling scandal in 1906, in which the championship games between the Maslin Tigers and Canton Bulldogs in Ohio may have been rigged, you could really have something special.
Talking to Greg Fisseri, his new book is called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. It can be hard to imagine today with the height of the NFL, but pro football was once a touch-and-go operation. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the early days of football. That's 800-642-1234. If you've dug into the family history of someone like Greg and your family who was involved in the early days of football, maybe with a little team out of Green Bay, I don't know, join in at 800-642-1234. Greg, I want to bring it home to Wisconsin a little bit here. Now, in the era you described before that gambling scandal, which we're going to get into in just a bit, teams were competing for players, and there were some hot commodities from a college in the Midwest called the University of Wisconsin. There were some players Absolutely. In high demand from here, right?
That's right. The Maslin Tigers recruited the entire Badgers backfield, three running backs, right in the midst of the 1906 season to give them an extra edge to get past the rival Canton Bulldogs. That's a great find.
Now, you mentioned there were two superpower teams in Ohio, and it culminates in 1906 in this weird, kind of complicated payoff scandal. Give us the broad strokes. How much trouble did this put pro football in at that time? How big an impact did the, tell us a little bit about the scandal and how it almost jeopardized pro football in the U.S.
Sure. So as the facts became clear, it turned out to be true. As the Maslin newspaper reported, after the second of the two championship games between the Tigers and the Bulldogs that year, one of the Tigers players had received $50,000 to offer to various players in a pool to get them to fix the outcomes of these games. And they wanted them to split them and then perhaps play a third game for and get more people to come and buy more tickets and so on. Rumors were circulating, and there were denials made, and the games went on, and as it turned out, they did split those games, and that led more people to believe that the games were fixed. So the Maslin paper came out with a story the following day after a big bar fight broke out in which some people accused the Canton players of fixing the games, and they denied it, and somebody went through the glass window just like in a Burt Reynolds movie. But the story in the Maslin paper did admit that there was an attempted bribe and that they kicked the player off of their team for doing so. And they also accused the Canton captain, Blondie Wallace, of colluding in this scam. And he vigorously denied it. And even the other player from Maslin who participated denied it, that Wallace was involved. But nonetheless, he could never clear his name. So as that trial, and he sued the Maslin paper for libel, as that trial dragged on for a couple of years, people lost patience and lost interest in the game. And they didn't trust that it was on the up and up. So it dragged, the effects of it dragged on basically from 1906 until 1915. Football continued to be played, but it went back to the local and amateur, semi-pro level at best, and just lost the instant popularity that it had gained when all the best players in the country had been attracted to that Eastern Ohio. So it wasn't until Jim Thorpe came back around and was recruited by a fellow named Jack Cusack, who volunteered to run the second version of the Canton Bulldogs. He was actually the ball boy or equipment kid for Canton back in the first era in 1906, and he loved the experience so much, he stepped up and said he wanted to help resurrect the game. And it was his idea to bring Jim Thorpe in after Thorpe had won the gold medals for the decathlon and pentathlon in the 1912 Olympics. He was the world's greatest athlete, national icon, and they thought if Thorpe played, people would come back. And they were right. People loved Jim Thorpe, and he brought thousands of fans to the games.
We're talking with Greg Fisseri about his new book. It's called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the early days of pro football, before there even was a National Football League? This conversation bringing back memories for you about maybe stories you heard from family members or others about the old days of pro football. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the early days of professional football in America. Our guest is Greg Fisseri, author of the new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest about the pre-NFL days. Let's bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Rob. So my thought that I've had for a while just about pro football is, what if we went back to something more resembling like the original helmets and pads, not the leather ones, but where they just had the one, you know, small chin strap or whatever, and less shoulder pads and what, because I think that there'd be less CTE in terms of brain injuries as well as just other injuries, because the players could no longer be guided human missiles.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Greg, can you paint us a picture? What kind of padding and protective gear were these players wearing and not wearing when they played in this era?
They weren't wearing much more than some canvas pants and some knit jerseys. They had the option to stitch in some padding into their shoulders and maybe stick some wooden slats into their thighs. But I've heard that thought over the past few years, and my reaction to that is it probably wouldn't work very well. In fact, in 1905, more than 20 players died from football-related injuries, not necessarily on the field, but broken necks, backs, head injuries, and so on. And a lot of that had to do with the rules at the time, which included a flying wedge formation, in which it was a V formation, and the runner got behind the V and they sort of attacked the weakest link on the defense. And it was pretty brutal. So 1906 became a transformational year with the rules, when President Teddy Roosevelt forced some rule changes to try to fix the game. People thought he might kill it, but he didn't. He liked the game. He liked the concept of masculine Christianity and the Rough Riders from the military that he put together. But so he got some of the luminaries of the game, Walter Camp, Amos Alonzo Stagg, John Heisman, to form a committee that became the NCAA to implement a line of scrimmage and the forward pass and 10 yards instead of 5 for a first down. I think things to open up the game, because it was so brutal before that. So I think probably the more pads we have, and the better, but I don't know how to, I'm not sure any helmet is going to solve the injury issue at the pace that these men play at.
Marcus, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Greg Fisseri about his new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story, looking at the early days, the pre-NFL days. We're talking over 100 years ago of professional football here in the United States. Greg, can you talk a little more about what the game looked like? If an NFL fan of today went back and watched a game, what do you think might stand out about the action on the field and the tactics involved?
It wouldn't feel like there was much action if you've already seen what it's become today. I think it was a lot of, they called them mass plays, sort of like rugby. One of the main changes in the rule that diverted American football away from rugby was the snapback, which, you know, sort of breaking up plays from a constant, the constant movement and scrums in rugby. So it was just a lot of pushing and shoving the ball down the field, sort of like a contest of strength. But slowly, I think the game became faster and faster, and, you know, fits and starts with rule changes. 1906, as I said, was pivotal. But even with the first forward pass, and by the way, my great-grandfather snapped the ball for the first forward pass with the Massillon Tigers in 1906. Fun footnote. But it was a fumble when there was an incomplete pass. So it wasn't like they were chucking the ball, you know, 40 times a game right away.
Now, I'm looking at pictures, and you've got a lot of great pictures in your book, Greg. Your great-grandpa looks like a pretty big guy by the standards of the time. By the standards of modern-day NFL, I'm guessing even he would look pretty tiny lined up on an offensive line.
Yeah, Big Bob Shiring, as he was called, was about 240, 250 at center, and pretty dominant with the 6 straight world championships. So there were several players, the backs, quarterbacks, running backs, 160 to 180 pounds was about it. There was a fellow named Arthur Poe from Princeton, who was a relative of Edgar Allan Poe, and he was an All-American, great, fast player, and his knee would pop out all the time. They said during the middle of the game, they would stop the game. But he went about 170 pounds at best.
Now, Greg, you mentioned we had this attempted bribery scandal, and your great-grandpa said no to this, by the way, but we had this attempted bribery scandal in Ohio. It set back pro football, but the teams are talking about this Ohio center of gravity in pro football. In a lot of ways, this set the stage for the formation of the NFL, 14 years later, right?
Absolutely. After the initial Pittsburgh era for 10 years, which is the birthplace. Canton still calls itself the cradle of pro football, which people don't quite get the nuance, but they recognize that they weren't the birthplace, but they have the Hall of Fame because the NFL was founded there in 1920, not because pro football started there. But nonetheless, it really matured there and was reborn there with Jim Thorpe and led to the founding of the what was first called the American Pro Football Association in 1920 and 21, but they changed the name to the National Football League. But that's where the game really flourished.
And Greg, I got to ask, you mentioned seeing some of those photos up on the wall and then finding more of them. Do they have a prominent place in your home now?
Absolutely. Those three main larger frame ones still inhabit the wall of my billiard room, just like they did in my grandmother's billiard room. And it was pretty rare for a grandparent back in those days, especially in Pittsburgh, to have a billiard room. And most of the time they were cellars, very raw and you know, dirty. But she had a very elegant home in her community, which set them apart from many others there. And it made me feel like they were something special, and they were special because of my great grandfather's legacy and the patriarch of the family that he was as a successful businessman and leader in their community as a justice of the peace after his pro football career. So his legacy of character and integrity is really special, because imagine that he was an eighth grade graduate only from Pittsburgh who had to go to work at the Westinghouse Airbrake Corporation to help his family. And he rose to the peak of pro football surrounded by Ivy League educated players who were the best in the country from elite institutions. And they made him their captain. So that's very powerful to me and inspired me to understand more about him.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much. It's at gridironlegacy.com. If you'd like a signed copy.
Greg Fasseri is the author of the new book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. Coming up after the news, former President Trump and a number of alleged accomplices face new charges in Georgia for their attempts to change the 2020 presidential election outcome. We'll dig into those new indictments. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.